This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. As a cultural advisor in Afghanistan in 2010 and 11, Carol Burke regularly ventured beyond the safety of the base to talk with Afghans. In the months leading up to her deployment, she frequently dreamed of being killed. She'd been in war zones before as a journalist, but somehow the danger felt different this time. It was then that Carol decided to do what soldiers have been doing for millennia, writing a death letter, a message for her loved ones should she not make it back. The experience moved her to explore the private and painful death letter tradition throughout history and conflicts. Her article, To Be Read in the Event of My Death, is online at Narratively. And Carol Burke, welcome to the program.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
So the death letter tradition is as old as war. Is it something that soldiers are encouraged to do or prepared to do in getting ready for deployments?
They are, and as a matter of fact, some units, a commander or sergeant in charge will actually require all of his soldiers to write these. And in the past, it went along with making sure that you had a will, that everything was taken care of as you headed off into harm's way.
And so does everybody follow the directions and write them?
No, and some units don't. And many individuals deploying choose not to. I interviewed a couple of former Special Forces soldiers, and one of the things they admitted is they said, look, we're these high-speed guys, and since so many people are wounded and sent home, and the survivability is so much greater than it was in previous wars. And he was a little sheepish when he said this. And he said, we don't want somebody going through our pockets and finding this mushy letter.
Oh, wow.
So there is some sense of, even in death, assuming the lean, mean fighting machine image.
Well, you point to the resistance that some people have to talking about them or to writing them. Is there something superstitious there?
There can be. Some soldiers report that this tradition that has a little bit of magic associated with it, like a lot of the things that soldiers carry into war with them, if you talk about it too much, the magic will dissipate. And the idea is, in many ways, I think it's kind of prophylactic. Mm-hmm. You do this ritual of writing this letter before you head off, and then in a way you bracket all of that and leave it behind, and you can concentrate fully on the challenges that are ahead of you.
Now, Carol, you didn't tell your husband or family about these premonitions, these death dreams that you had. Did you tell them about the letters that you wrote to them?
When I left, I left three letters in a metal box that we have with important documents. And I just said to my husband, I left these letters in case I don't return. That's all I said.
What did you write in the letters?
I basically thanked all the people I cared about for making my life a full life. I encouraged them as soon as they could to transform loss and sorrow into an active life, getting on with life without me. And then I did it turns out I didn't realize at the time what a lot of these letters do, which is the kind of look back over one shoulder from another dimension, saying things like, if it is possible to look back, know that I will be watching you with pleasure and love and concern and that kind of farewell.
Did it help you to write that? Did it make you feel better, more protected in any way?
Well, what it did, interestingly, and I've been thinking a lot about this, is that, first of all, I didn't realize this would happen, but I never had another dream about my own death after writing these letters.
Well, that's fascinating.
Never. And it was, in a way, kind of a magic ritual. And it also pulled together some threads so that I could go on and know that I had left a fond goodbye for the people I care about.
You dug up several examples throughout history of these death letters, one from the Civil War, just days before the first Battle of Bull Run. Now, what got to you about this one in particular?
Well, I think that it was the soldier actually, or the officer in this case, actually contemplating what was probably likely to happen or imminent. And in a sense, once you finish a letter, you put some kind of boundary on all of that fraught emotion.
Let's hear that letter. This is from Major Sullivan Ballou, and this reading is from Ken Burns' documentary, The Civil War.
I know how American civilization now leans upon the triumph of the government, and how great a debt we owe to those who went before us through the blood and suffering of the Revolution. And I am willing, perfectly willing, to lay down all my joys in this life to help maintain this government and to pay that debt. Sarah, my love for you is deathless. It seems to bind me with mighty cables that nothing but omnipotence can break. And yet my love of country comes over me like a strong wind and bears me irresistibly with all those chains to the battlefield. The memory of all the blissful moments I've enjoyed with you come crowding over me, and I feel most deeply grateful to God and you that I've enjoyed them for so long. And how hard it is for me to give them up and burn to ashes the hopes of future years, when, God willing, we might still have lived and loved together and see our boys grown up to honorable manhood around us. If I do not return, my dear Sarah, never forget how much I loved you, nor that when my last breath escapes me on the battlefield, it will whisper your name. Forgive my many faults and the many pains I have caused you. How thoughtless, how foolish I have sometimes been. But, oh, Sarah, if the dead can come back to this earth and flit unseen around those they love, I shall always be with you in the brightest day and the darkest night. Always. Always. And when the soft breeze fans your cheek, it shall be my breath, or the cool air, your throbbing temple, it shall be my spirit passing by. Sarah, do not mourn me dead. Think I am gone, and wait for me, for we shall meet again.
We're speaking with Carol Burke, who's been a journalist in several war zones and has also served as a cultural advisor in Afghanistan in 2010 and 2011. It was in preparing for that deployment that she did what soldiers have been doing for millennia. She wrote a death letter to be opened in the event of her death, and she wrote about the experience for Narratively. You also found a death letter in the form of a blog post by someone who called himself Jikar, or Major Andy Olmsted in real life. Now, this was to be uploaded in the event of his death. What did you read in that letter that hit you?
This officer had written many blogs while deployed and was commenting on his experiences in Iraq. He was writing those really for a community of readers who read the blog and for other bloggers. So he wants to leave them a permanent record. But interestingly, what happened with his blog is that one of his fellow bloggers, not a family member, who got to know him well just through the process of blogging, she promised to upload it for him. And that blog was read by a much, much larger audience, and it's very moving. He's very articulate. And he does what a lot of bloggers do, which is, in a way, caution against extraordinary sorrow. And as a matter of fact, some of these letters that soldiers write are very funny. Some of them are, well, I don't have much money left, and I have a little bit in this insurance that I have, and I don't want you all to sit around moaning my death. I want you to buy, you know, get all the booze you want to, have a great party, celebrate. And so there is that tradition as well, kind of flying in the face of death. And that, too, I think, is a pretty protective gesture.
Well, here's an example of one such letter that was cited in your article. This is from Major Andy Olmsted. He was serving in Iraq when he wrote this letter as a web post to be published in the event of his death. And he was killed by insurgents in 2008.
What I don't want this to be is a chance for me or anyone else to be maudlin. I'm dead. That sucks, at least for me and my family and friends. But all the tears in the world aren't going to bring me back, so I'd prefer that people just remember the good things about me rather than mourning my loss. If it turns out a specific number of tears will in fact bring me back to life, then by all means, break out the onions.
Of course, those who are writing these or constructing these letters use the medium of the time. And during World War II, they sometimes appeared in newspapers. And now I will warn you, if you want to have a good cry, the video dedications to those killed in combat, you know, often with letters read by wives and friends and parents and loved ones of soldiers, are just absolutely heartbreaking. So what are these? What's the purpose these are going to serve? They're going to go far beyond the family circle out into the wider public.
Yes, and I think that also soldiers often during deployment produce not their own letters, but their own DVDs. They have video cameras on their cell phones. Often family find these farewell videos on a laptop that's returned. And often those are very personal and meant for family members, but a family member paying tribute to the loss of this person will upload them to Facebook or YouTube. And so they are having wider currency. And I think that in the next 5 years, we're going to see a lot more of these uploaded.
You, Carol, did leave Afghanistan safely and intact. What did you do with your death letter? And do you know what soldiers, Marines, fighting forces traditionally do with theirs?
A lot of them don't retain them. They've come back safely, so they dispose of them. Some just keep them hidden away. One soldier told me he was disabled, and it took him 5 years before he showed the letter to his wife. And he said that it had so much resonance and meaning for her that now he has a project in which he's trying to collect these letters from other soldiers. So I think that this is an effort to document what actually happens and to show the meaning that's involved in these rituals.
Well, Carol Burke, thank you for opening up what is normally quite a private ritual for people. I appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Carol Burke is professor at the University of California, Irvine, and author of Camp All-American, Hanoi Jane, and The High and Tight. She's currently writing a memoir about her experiences in Iraq and Afghanistan, and her article, To Be Read in the Event of My Death, is online at Narratively. There's a link at wordofmouthradio.org. And we want to mention terrific illustrations for the piece by artist and graphic novelist Julia Gaffer. She's a native of Concord, New Hampshire. Can you die of a broken heart? It's a phenomenon long observed among elderly spouses who die within months or even days of each other. And it turns out there's a medical reason for it. Why broken hearts kill, when word of mouth continues. is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. My paternal grandparents died within days of each other. Gramps after a long illness, and then Nana had a heart attack 5 days later. She died of a broken heart, said one relative or family friend after another. They were together for a good part of the 20th century, but their linked death sounded more like the stuff of a tragic gothic novel. Researchers at the University of Birmingham in England have found that a broken heart can kill the elderly by severely taxing the immune system. And for more, we turn to Dr. Anna Phillips, who is lead author of the study. Anna Phillips, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you.
So, did my grandmother die of a broken heart?
I think it's possibly more a broken immune system, although I couldn't definitely say in the case of your grandmother, but what we are seeing is that it's the stress of a bereavement can actually have a negative effect on the immune system of older people.
What happens to the immune system during bereavement?
Well, one of the things we were looking at was the action of a particular cell called a neutrophil. And the neutrophil cell is really important in older people because it fights off pneumonia, which is a big killer of older people. So we were looking at this neutrophil cell in bereaved people compared to those who hadn't had a recent bereavement and just seeing whether it functioned properly, whether it was able to eat bacteria and whether it was able to kill them. And we found that bereaved individuals, their neutrophils actually couldn't produce enough killing chemicals to actually get rid of bacteria effectively.
How did you conduct the study?
With the help of a local hospice, St Mary's Hospice in Birmingham, we recruited people who'd had a bereavement in the past 2 months. And then once we knew their age and gender, we also recruited a control group who were the same age and gender, so we had a nice match, but just people who hadn't had a bereavement. And we would go to their homes or they would come to the university and we'd take a blood sample and they'd complete a variety of questionnaires. And it's in that blood sample that we'd look for neutrophil function.
So many of us recall our first heartache, you know, when we were convinced that we would die from the pain. Do young bodies have the same kind of compromised immunity as those under stress as they're older?
One of the really interesting things that we found was that younger people seem to be more protected than older people against a bereavement. So we also recruited a young group, so aged 18 to 45, and a young control group as well. And while the young bereaved group were just as depressed and anxious and upset and stressed by the bereavement, obviously, they actually retained their neutrophil function. So their neutrophils were still able to produce killing chemicals.
Well, we know that bodies age individually, but is there a sort of time period when the immune system gets compromised by grief?
For most people, it's over the age of 65 where you start seeing a negative impact of aging on immune function generally, so things like reduced response to medical vaccinations. So although people age at different rates biologically, usually by after age 65 you'd expect to see a detriment. And what we think we're finding is that younger people are protected against the negative effects on immunity because they have a different balance of stress hormones and other hormones that sort of helps protect their immune cells. Whereas older people, when they experience stress and produce stress hormones, because of their age, they don't produce enough of another hormone called DHEA, which can counterattack and counterbalance the effects of the stress hormones.
So often people who are dealing with grief are treated either psychologically or spiritually in many cases. Now that this has been identified, can grief be treated differently, medically, to keep survivors alive?
I think there's certainly different ways that we could go to try and help people cope with bereavement and certainly help them from a physical health point of view. One of the things that we could try is putting right that hormonal balance in older people, possibly by giving them DHEA just during that vulnerable period to try and right the balance between their stress hormone cortisol and DHEA. Another thing that people can do themselves and sort of naturally boost their good hormone levels and decrease their stress hormone levels is making sure they keep moderately active and making sure that they don't socially isolate themselves, so still staying in touch with people.
Dr. Anna Phillips, you work in behavioral medicine. Is your work focused on grief?
My work's generally focused on psychological factors and how they influence the immune system. So while we've looked at bereavement as one particular stressor, we do also look at the impact of a variety of different types of stress, including things like a physical trauma, like a hip fracture, and we also look at depression.
Dr. Anna Phillips, thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Anna Phillips is lead author of a study conducted at the University of Birmingham on the effects of bereavement on the elderly. The findings were recently published in the Journal of Immunity and Aging. You can read a summary at wordofmouthradio.org. More word of mouth coming right after the break. Please stay with us.
Word of mouth!
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Death has been depicted in countless works of art over the ages, but there's one project that looks like no other. Here's the story. Between 1913 and 1971, the remains of more than 5,000 patients were cremated on the grounds of the Oregon State Psychiatric Hospital. Their ashes were sealed individually in copper canisters. More than 3,000 of them remained unclaimed by family or friends. So in 1976, the hospital moved them to a memorial vault underground and pretty much forgot about them. Artist David Maisel first saw them in 2005 and has since created a photographic series of the remains entitled Library of Dust. As producer Sarah Lilly found out, even after people are gone, they leave their marks in all kinds of ways.
Leafing through the library of dust is sometimes like staring into a yearbook of the socially dispossessed. David Maisel understands why.
These were people who had not been claimed by their families on their deaths, and so in a way they'd been written out of their family histories. The existence of these canisters had basically been secret for decades and decades, and so that kind of secret history really captivated me. There's a kind of charge in the room, too. I mean, here you are in this room with 3,500 souls. I have had people feel very, in a way, offended by this work because it deals with death, which is a taboo, and it deals with crazy people, right, quote unquote, which is taboo. And it combines that with a kind of spectacular beauty. And that combination is really taboo.
What I haven't yet told you is this. The canisters don't just look normal. For the 24 years in which they sat in an underground vault, it was flooded repeatedly, unbeknownst to anyone. Finally, in 2000, they were moved to a dry storage room. And that's where David Maisel first got a peek at the remarkable ways in which the copper surfaces of the canisters had evolved, each different from the next.
They're, in a sense, mineralogical portraits of the individuals who are within them.
Oh, my God, look at that one. That almost looks like a cave drawing, doesn't it? Like a bird?
That's Lynn Sherman, who's a painter from Key West.
That's gorgeous, wow. And then this, oh, this has an underwater quality. The basic color in most of them is this wonderful burnt orange with gold highlights. And then when this cobalt blue comes in and the cerulean blue, it's really like, whew, look at these. They look sort of like they erupted. That's so soft, and this looks kind of violent.
Mineral deposits bloom across huge portions of many of the canisters with special buildup near the seams. Electric indigos, bright aquas, thick encrustations of white, green, and blue, and gleaming copper underneath it all.
The colors are just phenomenal. The upper half or so of this canister has got the black and the red color of what looks like to be copper oxide. You see that when you look at the surface of a penny.
Jim Webster is a geologist and curator of mineral deposits at the American Museum of Natural History. In his very cool office, with its rocks and charts and maps, I asked him, what's going on here?
I suspect that much of the blue is either a copper sulfate or a copper carbonate mineral. Azurite, which is a natural blue copper carbonate mineral, And then the green, which is malachite. And the other thing I see, which is fairly apparent, is a white salty material. And there are copper chlorides that form a white material. And there are chlorines everywhere. And my understanding is these canisters were exposed to flooding multiple times inside of a vault. A concrete floor would be easily a source for the carbonate. And really, the copper, the carbonate, they're not extremely soluble in water, so it would take years.
We don't talk about what happens to our bodies when we die. We don't want to think about those things. And yet here is this example of this kind of spectacular mineralogical, alchemical afterlife that these canisters are undergoing.
Most living organisms are largely water. So when a body is cremated, the water is released, is driven off as steam. Our bones are largely calcium phosphate. And so, in fact, they don't burn, and they're stable to very high temperatures. So at the end of burning of a human body, there will be the charred remains of our bones. And so apparently those bones are crushed up to make a fine powder, and the powder is what's put inside these canisters.
Webster explains that the phosphorus in the bones could have combined with the copper to create the mineral turquoise on some of the canisters. But still, it's hard to nail these pellets down because the colors are still changing.
As I returned to the hospital over the course of 2 years, there were certain canisters that I would look at again and again. Something that appeared a kind of deep midnight blue might become almost electric cobalt months later.
The water level, the humidity during a given day, the temperature, a cold day versus a hot day, potentially the amount of carbon dioxide from 1 year to another, all of these factors may well cause these minerals to change from one to another.
All this information, these canisters, the colors, the ongoing changes, remind me in some way of the landscape of Iceland. Stand atop a mountain ridge there, and you see geological history writ large in forms of lava, turf, and sand.
Well, in rocks, it's almost like people liken it to the pages in a book, kind of opening a book of Earth history.
So maybe the Library of Dust is like the ancient Icelandic sagas, or like footprints on a dirt path, or the smell of someone who's no longer in the room.
I think that's what I'm looking for in my work, the tension between the natural sciences, what's verifiable, what's real, and the unknown or the unrepresentable. And so that, I think, is what activates these images. What is real and what is imaginary? What is measurable and definable? And what is eventually ineffable?
I'm Sarah Lilly.
Stick around for more Word of Mouth. Up next, we're going to kick off Good Gig. It's a series of conversations with individuals who have landed their dream job with a passionate rare bookseller you may know from the Antiques Roadshow. Good Gigs coming at you after the break from Word of Mouth.
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 This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Being able to assess what something should cost is a valuable skill. Real estate appraisers evaluate land and property to make sure no one gets burned. Athletic scouts can calculate the worth of amateur athletes, beating others to the punch. And then there is that passionate breed which can appraise rare, collectible items. Ken Gloss is a lion among the latter. He's proprietor of the Brattle Bookshop in Boston, one of the largest and oldest antiquarian bookshops in the country, and an appraiser of rare books and manuscripts for the Antiques Roadshow since 1998. He's with us to kick off our series, Good Gig. Ken, a hearty welcome to Word of Mouth.
Well, thank you very much. Happy to be here.
You brought in so many fantastic-looking rare books. Let's take just a look. What do we begin with?
Well, I would say one of the things that if you want to start off with a newspaper, it's from April 15th, 1865.
Ooh.
Look at the front page, see all the ads, open it up, and by the way, President Lincoln was assassinated. But it's not the headline in the paper. But you know, this is the way somebody in Providence, Rhode Island might have first seen that President Lincoln was assassinated.
If he got to the second page.
If he got to the second page, past the ads.
It is amazing. And it's so hardy, this paper stock. How much is this worth?
Well, that's worth about $250, $350. The thing is, paper from the Revolutionary War, the Civil War, was actually high-quality paper. Around the 1880s, 90s, it became more wood pulp. And, of course, if you have a modern newspaper from the 1930s, 1940s, they'll crumble in your hand. But if they use this quality paper now, your newspaper would be totally unaffordable. So it's a trade-off.
Ken, just opening it up and fluttering it around, I realize that this is a sound we're hearing less and less, the sound of a newspaper opening up. Probably same for books.
Same for books to a degree. I think people still like books, still read them. What we're losing, and it's not necessarily a terrible thing, is reference in particular. Nobody buys an encyclopedia anymore.
Right.
Very few people buy dictionaries. I think the rare books are going to be the rare books and going to be valuable. I think the bestsellers probably never were and probably never will be. But I'll tell you one great advantage is you can be in Africa in the middle of nowhere. If you can get an internet connection nowadays, you can access all the world's knowledge very cheaply and freely. So for society, that's great. For used bookstores, maybe. Mm. But I'm not too worried. I think I'll be able to do this as long as I want.
Well, I'm looking at some other ones in front of you. It looks like you've got a cookbook of some type.
I have the Woman's Suffrage Cookbook. I mean, you know, when you have charity cookbooks and so on, they've had them for years to come. This is from the late 1880s. People collect things on women's suffrage. This is probably a $500, maybe even $1,000 book. It's a very specialized area. But the people who are interested are really interested.
Okay. So is that book from your personal collection or is it available at your bookstore?
It's available at the bookstore.
Is that a fuzzy line there, Ken?
There's not a big fuzzy line. I'll tell you, most of the things that I get in the store, it's a business. So I buy and sell, and it's always what's coming in next. One time my daughter said to me when she was in high school, she said, "All the great things, don't you wish you still had them?" And I looked at her and said, "Yeah, so I could sell them again." But, I mean, you know, when you're dealing with holding letters of Jefferson, Washington, Lincoln, and you're touching them and you know that Thomas Jefferson held this item and touched it. We one time got a letter in, and it was a letter, and Thomas Jefferson was talking about what to do about traitors and terrorists.
Wow.
This was just after the 9/11. He was talking about the War of 1812, mm-hmm. and what he said was they should get the full protection of the law and nothing else. And
wow.
You could have just applied that.
But the Patriot Act that was going on then.
Exactly. But, you know, actually sitting there, touching, holding that item, it still thrills me. But I don't keep large collections myself.
Well, that's a question. I mean, I've heard there are two types of collectors. There are those who advocate for, you know, enjoying the items, holding them in their hands, as you're saying, or those who you do put the white gloves on everything and store them away, unseen, and they're considered financial investments. What is it to you?
Well, a lot of people, it's collecting. For me, like I say, it's my business in doing this, but I get the great thrill of holding it or getting it to the right library,
or
the right
reading.
Person.
Do you read them?
Well, I read some of them. If books and publishers had to depend on everybody reading every book they had before they bought the next one, we'd all go out of business. There's always that one on the shelf or the pile by the bed that you want to read. But I'll tell you, there's a middle ground between what you just said. I have friends, collectors, people who will buy two copies.
Wow.
Of everything. One, the rare copy they put behind the glass. Number two, the one they read. So there's the middle ground, too.
What are you looking for when you're appraising a book, given that rarity is just one factor in the value?
Well, usually what you're looking for is, well, first of all, what's the title? Mm-hmm. Who's the author? What's the book about? But then you start looking, is it an early edition? Is it a first edition? What's the condition of the book? Is it signed by someone significant, the author, the publisher, someone famous who owned it? And all of this you do very, very quickly. And then you come up with a general idea or price. Or There's no way any one person can know everything there is to know about books. But the key is that you have to know where to ask or who to ask or where to look things up. So part of it is the quick look is, oh, yeah, I know what this is, or this needs more work. I've got to spend some time on it.
Now, you've been working as an appraiser on Antiques Roadshow for some time now, since 98. One of the reasons I think that that show is so compelling is seeing the genuine reactions that we get to hear from people having their goods appraised. Now, here's an example. A woman who spoke with you, now you told her that two letters sent to her aunt Bernice by Sigmund Freud and Carl Jung were worth somewhere between $15,000 and $20,000. Let's hear.
And they were just, they were up. She was cleaning it out. They were inside a book. They fell out of the book. She came to the show. You know, obviously she knew they had some value, but she wasn't quite expecting what she got.
Oh, my goodness. Oh, my goodness. That's wonderful. I think I'm going to have to preserve these a little bit better than just leaving them folded in the envelopes.
Isn't that everyone's fantasy, that they have something fantastically valuable? So what does it feel like for you when you tell people their goods are indeed valuable or, in some cases, worthless?
Well, of course, you always like to be able to tell somebody that it's valuable. One of the things that I tell people is sometimes people present a book for me to look at and they go, you know, we really don't think this is valuable. And I have to say to them, you know, I hate to agree with you. But many people, what you don't realize when you do a lot of this appraising, many people are absolutely thrilled mm-hmm. when I tell them a book is not valuable.
Really?
Well,
the pressure's off?
The pressure's off. They don't have to take care of it. Many, many cases, if it's a children book, they want to give it to their grandchildren. If you say it's worth $200 or $300, it doesn't change anybody's life. If you say it's worth $20,000 or $30,000, well, that's a whole different reaction. I had a lady at one of my talks, and she had a whole box of papers, and they were nice. They'd been up in the attic, and we're lifting through them, and then we hit one, and it says, A Declaration of Independence.
What?
It wasn't the first edition. It was about a week later. It was worth $750,000.
Oh, my goodness.
And my guess is she lived in an old house that probably had been in the attic since 1776. But needless to say, she was happy.
Wow. You must have seen a lot of really valuable pieces like that come through your bookstore and through your appraisals and your shows.
It's some of the things that I just feel fortunate. Not everything that I've owned. I got called by a museum just to do an appraisal. And I saw what they wanted me to look at. I said, look, I do a lot of favors for them. The great museum. I'll do it for free, but I don't want to do it from your website, from anything. I want to hold
it, touch it.
Yeah. Anyways, a 4-page handwritten letter of Paul Revere's ride by Paul Revere.
Oh, my goodness.
So I'm sitting there holding a 4-page account of Paul Revere's ride done a week after the ride and him describing in detail what happened. And this is Paul Revere's.
So, Ken, is that the thrill of the chase for you? I mean, I'm sure you have days that are a little more mundane than that.
Yeah. Although, in many cases, we go to somebody's house. We go up to the 5th floor walk-up. They have 2,000 general used books. It's 95 degrees out. You get a great workout. But that's the part of the business that a lot of people don't realize. But that's as important as sometimes the very rare and esoteric and fun things.
Well, I'm going to play another clip. In 2012, sure. You appraised a first edition of Cormac McCarthy's book, The Orchard Keeper, told the owner that at first glance might have been valued at about $3,500, but then you noticed something. Let's hear the clip.
One of the things that you run into nowadays is where the dust jacket is 90% of the value. There are many people who copy a dust jacket. They can do it incredibly well nowadays.
Okay.
So the book, as it is, with a dust jacket that's not right, is worth retail $100 or so.
And it was originally worth $5. It was free to me. So if it's a $100 book, it's a $100 book.
Well, he's pretty good-spirited about it. But you know, this is kind of an odd case. But over the course of your career, especially now that printing and design techniques are so sophisticated, have you seen a lot of these so-called rare books that are fakes?
You don't see many rare books that are fakes, because to fake a rare book is a huge job and actually could be more expensive than the rare book would be. Mm. What you do see is fakes of the inscriptions, signatures. One of the things, though, that does happen is the paper dust jacket on a book can be way more valuable. Like that clip, if you have The Great Gatsby, you have a nice first edition without the dust jacket, it's worth a few thousand dollars. With the jacket, it might be worth a few hundred thousand dollars.
Wow.
You got to watch out for that once in a while, but it's still the signatures, the inscriptions that we watch for more.
You know what collectors want. Have you ever made a terrible bet on and put out a lot of money on something that didn't sell?
Well, what I always tell people, if you're either a collector, in the business, whatever, the biggest mistake you can ever make is not ever making a mistake. Because if you don't make a mistake, it means you're being so conservative and passing up lots and lots of good things. Of course, you can't help but make mistakes. Sometimes I've bought books, paid a good price, and hadn't checked them closely enough and realized that maybe there's a few pages missing, which have brought them down to nothing. And then once in a while, I've missed on a signature, and you have to. You can't do it. But again, the biggest mistake is not taking chances. And a lot of times, those chances you have to do either at an auction or from another person, just have to do it on right then and there,
yeah.
And there's no time to do the research. So you take a chance.
You got to know what you're doing. Well, old books are not always valued just for their contents or their rarity, sometimes as aesthetic objects. I noticed on your website that it's specifically for decorators. So do a lot of people come in and say, I don't necessarily want to read or collect books, but I want books that are going to look good on a shelf?
Well, first of all, when you talk about decorators, a lot of movies come in,
right.
And advertising sets. We've had a few recently. We one time had, and this was one of the stranger orders, someone ordered 6,000 red books. They had to be some shade of red. Now it's.
And did you have them?
Yeah, we got them. But it actually made more sense. It was for Ann Taylor, and they had a red dress. They wanted 100 books in the display. They had 60 stores. 6,000 red books.
Wow.
But yeah, there are people who just, you know, they want their living room or library to look intelligent. They have no care or clue, whatever. They just want to fill up the shelves. On the other hand, there are beautifully done, beautifully illustrated covers and designs. And graphically, those can be really, really beautiful. And so people are collecting the design of the book as art, and that's a whole different type as opposed to, oh, just fill the shelves up.
Now, Ken Gloss, your family has been doing this for a couple of generations now. Had you not been born into this, what do you think you would be doing, or can you imagine yourself doing anything else?
Well, I have a degree in chemistry from
no
University.
No kidding.
I was going to get a doctoral in Wisconsin, and in 1973, my father wasn't well. I had worked at the store all through my younger years. Not necessarily by choice, mm-hmm. but it was a family business. And he wasn't feeling that well. I needed a year off. That year now has been about 40 years. and tell you the truth, I don't regret not being in a laboratory somewhere. I mean, this is like a treasure hunt. It's like being Jim Hawkins almost every day, not knowing where you're going to go, who you're going to meet. It's really a lot of it. It's the people and the houses. And, of course, you want to find good books and so on.
Ken Gloss, proprietor of the Brattle Bookshop in Boston. What a pleasure speaking with you.
Thank you.
Ken's also an appraiser for the Antiques Roadshow, and there's much more on his bookstore and his many public speaking events at wordofmouthradio.org. Have you got a good gig? Well, we're looking for guests for our series, so if you love your job, we'd like to know about it, especially if it's a job few people do or think of as work. You can go to our Facebook page and tell us about what you do, or send a brief email to wordofmouth@nhpr.org and put good gig in the subject line. That's wordofmouth@nhpr.org with good gig in the subject line. And with that, we are out of time, and thank you for listening to our gig for today. There's much more at wordofmouthradio.org. You can also follow us. You can send us your feedback or share your ideas for the program on Facebook and on Twitter. We find some of the most fascinating stories through word of mouth. Let's hear.
hear yours. I'm Virginia Prescott. We'll be back with more Word of Mouth tomorrow at 2 on New Hampshire Public Radio.
Word of Mouth is produced by
Taylor Quimby,
Logan Shannon,
and senior producer Maureen McMurray.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals
and not those of NHPR,
its Board of Trustees,
or its underwriters. Word of Mouth is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio.